Hello, and welcome to the Scott Mize Show, a podcast focused on health, diet, bodybuilding, and philosophy. I interview experts, doctors, coaches, and N equals one case studies to answer your questions about improving health, achieving your best physique, and making sustainable progress. We'll cover topics from carnivore and ketogenic diets, to bodybuilding, to life philosophy, and everything in between. Enjoy the show. This episode is brought to you by Element Electrolytes. This month, we're switching it up with an exclusive offer that's only for VIP Element partners, including CarnivoreCast listeners. You can now receive this free sample pack, along with any regular purchase, when you use my custom link, which is provided in the show notes or my Instagram link in bio. That's drinklmnt.com/CarnivoreCast, all one word. And as I said, I'll include the link in the show notes. Element Electrolytes are convenient, evidence-based, and delicious. And get yours today to help support the show. Thank you.
This is a quick disclaimer before we start the show. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as medical advice. And please consult with your physician before making any changes to your diet, exercise regime, or medications. Thank you, and on to the show. Today's guest is Sally Norton, MPH, an expert in oxalates, Ivy League nutritionist, and author of the book, Toxic Superfoods, How Oxalate Overload is Making You Sick, and How to Get Better. Sally has a degree in nutrition from Cornell and a master's of public health from the University of North Carolina. She managed a five-year National Institute of Health-funded program at UNC Medical School. I had the pleasure of meeting Sally years ago at Keto Fest in Connecticut, and she's just as friendly, helpful, and exciting as she is wise and ambitious. This is Sally's third time on the show, so please make sure you check out the previous episodes. Welcome back, Sally.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd love to start, for maybe folks who aren't as familiar with your story, two questions. One is, what are oxalates and why are they so bad? And then if you can weave in too, your personal story with learning about oxalates the hard way, I think that'd be a great way to start us off.
Yeah. So I got real interested in health early in life. Already in kindergarten, I would come home and tell my mother, if they told us how to eat, I would be into it. And you can see on my website, I was even featured in second grade for a nutrition lesson.
That's awesome.
Wanting to be healthy. And, you know, I think it started with having strep throat and things as a little preschooler and being given liquid penicillin, which is nasty, and being barred from the swimming pool and all that. So I became quite aware, especially after I had my tonsillectomy at age 5, that hanging around in hospitals and having surgeries and taking medication, that's all stuff that kind of wrecks all the fun in life. Like not going there. So I was interested in how to not do all that right from the get-go. And so by 12, I decided I would get a degree in nutrition so that I could help people not get sick with major diseases. Because it was in the 70s, we were in this war on cancer, and you know, diabetes was starting to show up as a bigger issue than it had been before. And things were starting to happen in the 70s with health. And I went to Cornell, and I remember distinctly learning about anti-nutrients in plants and how you shouldn't eat them with dinner because they lock up nutrients in your food. So things like tannins in tea and oxalates in tea have problems, and you just separate it out and just ignore it and then move on. And oh, by the way, we do put people with kidney stones on low oxalate diets. And there's a little mention of it over here and a little mention over here. So I know about oxalates. I know about the low oxalate diet, but I had no idea that you can really exceed your body's capacity eating normal, healthy foods. I grew up on beet greens and Swiss chard and started gardening as a 9-year-old and was told, yeah, Swiss chard is the thing to grow. It's cut and come again. You can plant once and harvest all season long. And my dad loved the greens too. And I grew up with rhubarb in the back of the house. These are all foods that concentrate and create a lot of oxalate in them. Rhubarb, beet greens, Swiss chard, spinach, the nuts. We used to have holiday Christmas Stollen, which is a German/European thing that's full of citrus peel and walnuts and raisins. That's all high oxalates. Everywhere. And there's chocolate. And I didn't know that I was eating a high oxalate food, the diet. And oxalate is this little chemical, really tiny, tiny, two carbon molecule with four oxygens. It is the most high oxygen to carbon ratio of any compound really in nature.
Interesting.
And it's easily made as an end product of oxidation. Plants create vitamin C in order to turn it into oxalate. They like oxalic acid for lots of reasons, and they use it to build calcium oxalate crystals. So the oxalate, this molecule, has a negative charge on it and can have two negative charges on it. And that creates an attraction to the positively charged molecules like calcium. And calcium oxalate get together in nature and they form this calcium oxalate bond that's pretty solid. And so plants can build these crystals that work to prevent, say, in a tree bark, bugs can't drill holes in the tree because they're building this armor made of this really hard stuff. Think of it like quartz. This calcium oxalate is harder than your teeth. But every time you're eating a kiwi or high oxalate foods that have these crystals, you're potentially even wearing your teeth. It's that hard. And those crystals, we don't get them in our bloodstream. They tend to irritate the gut and promote inflammation with little micro stress in the gut. But then we're also eating oxalic acid. So plants, certain plants, not all plants, but certain plants, a lot of ones that are popular now, make a lot of the oxalic acid and the crystals. And it turns out there's a limit to how much you can handle of this. Surprisingly, it's a toxin. Oxalic acid is because it's so good at grabbing calcium, iron, magnesium, you name it, metals. It's been used heavily in industry since the late 1700s for bleaching, cottons, leathers, taking the rust off of anything, polishing bronze and brass. You can remove all the rust from an engine, clean up a rusty anything with oxalic acid. And it's still in some cleaners today, like Barkeeper's Friend powder. Okay, so this ability to clean up metals, you're eating something that can clean up your metals. It means it's grabbing electrolytes that you need to operate your cells. Calcium and other things are critical electrolytes so that the electricity of life works, right? So a cell is a living being full of electricity because it has this sort of battery charge of positive on one side, negative on the other. And certain cells have to switch that back and forth rapidly, your nerve cells, your muscle cells. In order for them to function, they have to handle their electrolytes well and work with these charges and polarize and depolarize and do all this magic stuff. Calcium is the most important of all of them for a cell to function. If you're eating a lot of something that cleans up your calcium and cleans up your minerals and takes it and steals it, it starts mucking around with how everything works in your body.
Right. And what you mentioned, kidney stones, that's like the most well-known mainstream sign of high oxalate. What would you say is the second most, and maybe some other common effects of oxalates?
Well, most of them your doctor doesn't know much about, but as long as we're going to be in the urinary tract, let's think about the pelvis and the whole urinary tract. The body has to eliminate oxalate that you eat. It can't metabolize it and detoxify it. So it has to come out, and it's mostly the kidney's job to do it. And that's why it can get messing with the kidneys, even though the kidneys are specialized tissues designed to concentrate oxalate, because oxalate is a little bit part of our metabolism. The liver makes oxalate. It doesn't detox oxalate. It doesn't metabolize. It creates oxalate. That's what the liver does, but at a level you can handle, it's no problem that it's doing that if you have a healthy, normal function. Yeah. But the poor kidneys, they're designed to handle this, but you can so overdo it and you can cause kidney stress, all kinds of renal loss of renal function. And that whole, all the tubes that come from the kidneys to the bladder itself, the tube that lets you pee out, you know, all those tissues are potentially stressed out by too much oxalic acid coming out of the blood and the crystals that are forming in the urine as the urine is being made and as the urine is sitting in the bladder. You keep making crystals potentially of the oxalates. And that's very tough on the tissues. it wears them out. The acid itself gets in the way of the enzymes that produce energy for cells. Energy goes down. Ability to recover and respond to injury from the crystals goes down. The immune system comes in. You get inflammatory problems. You can end up with bladder pain symptoms. You can end up with nighttime urination, problems holding urine all day long, leaking. Just you name it, stuff can go wrong with your urinary tract, including inflamed prostate, problems with flow strength. So anything going on in the urinary tract that's keeping you up at night or waking you up could potentially be from overeating oxalates in the diet.
Yeah.
Then we have pelvic pain generally. Some women get genital pain, men get scrotal pain and these different issues. Potentially even infertility could be connected to oxalate. There's some tissues in the testes that probably accumulate oxalate as well, and probably attempt to excrete oxalate. It seems like all the fluids, all the ways the body pushes stuff out, whether it's saliva, eyes, mucus from the lungs, skin tissue, the fecal tissues, the urine, and even probably the sperm or the extraseminal fluids are also a way of releasing stuff the body's trying to get rid of.
Yeah. And does oxalate have a role in heart disease as well?
There has been suspicion of that since the mid-1950s. And there's been several researchers who've said so, and several who've looked at the mechanism of it. One of the mechanisms is that, well, it's causing inflammation in the vascular system. So it causes damage in the vascular system to have, potentially calcium loss in the blood. The oxalic acid itself that you absorb right into your bloodstream from your gut starts interfering with how the immune cells work. They start getting inflamed and distressed and putting out pro-inflammatory cytokines. The endothelial tissues that line all the vascular tissue, they have damage and inflammation effects. And it sits on the enzyme that helps them make energy. So they don't have as much energy potentially to repair when the damage and inflammation comes along. Their ability to fix that is slowed down. Mm. And then the red blood cells can get that same problem in a more severe way because they don't have the electron transport chain of the mitochondria because they don't have mitochondria. So they have to rely on glycolysis. And oxalate sits on the last enzyme that produces those little ATP molecules for the cell to work. And they tend to then, their ATP pumps slow down. See, in order for them to keep their levels of potassium and sodium correct, they have to move these ions around.
Sorry, I was just getting something out of my dog's mouth.
Let's save the dog. I wasn't sure if our connection was going
back. I have a puppy.
Puppies.
Yeah.
Puppy trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the red blood cells are needing to maintain the right amount of sodium in and out of the cell. So they have to pump sodium out of the cell. But when the ATP is low, those ATP pumps that do that work slow down and eventually they fill up with too much sodium, which pulls in water, and water can explode those cells. Those cells start popping open and dying young. So there's lots of potential problems in the vascular system from too much oxalate. And it's quite clear there's a genetic form of this disease that's very rare, but it's very interesting because it helps us see what excessive amounts of oxalates over the long haul can do to a person, or really high levels can do to a person. And almost every patient ends up with a classic vasculitis, which is inflammation of the vascular system. And you can get capillary beds that are kind of degenerating that can cause blindness and other problems because the capillaries that are feeding the tissues are not functional.
Carnivore and ketogenic diets can be an excellent way to combat diseases we commonly associate with aging and degeneration in the modern world. But if you're like me, you want to do everything possible to stay in your prime physically and mentally as long as you can, especially with me thinking about starting a family. I really value the most research-backed ingredients and science for bettering the aging process. Today's sponsor is NeuroHacker, which packs 7 of the most science-backed senolytic ingredients into one formula called Qualia Senolytic. And you can take it just 2 days a month for fast and noticeable benefits and for a much better aging process. I've been taking Qualia Senolytic for the last month, and I've already noticed a big improvement in my physical and mental energy for my family and friends, and my productivity has improved. I feel invigorated, I feel enthusiastic, and ready to get things done. It's also backed by a 100-day money-back guarantee, so that means you can try it for almost 3 full months, and if you don't like it, there's no risk. You can decide for yourself. If you're in your late 20s or older, adding Qualia Senolytic to your diet can play a crucial role in combating negative aging symptoms. Go to neurohacker.com/Scott for up to 50% off Qualia Senolytic. And as a listener of the show, you can use code Scott at checkout for an extra 15% off your first purchase. Again, it's risk-free. Just go to neurohacker.com/Scott to try Qualia Senolytic with code Scott and start aging on your own terms. Thanks, and back to the show.
And going back to your story, you mentioned eating a lot of Swiss chard and beetroot growing up. What was your own journey with oxalates and how did you experience it?
Well, in retrospect, you can pick through the carcass of your life and go, oh, you start to see connections all the way back. And I have a feeling the fact that I was having strep and problems as a kid and ear infections as a kid was already an oxalate problem.
Gotcha.
And then, of course, you start taking antibiotics and that increases your vulnerability to the toxic effects of a high oxalate diet. So you start off in this cycle. And by the time I was 12, I was having back pain and chemical sensitivities, fatigue, started having trouble concentrating and learning and performing in school. And I was just, the little bit that I dared to confess to family adults was told that it was just growing pains and I should shut up and not whine. And really not interested in the problems of children. But it's not fun to be waking up in the morning feeling slightly paralyzed with back pain when you're 12.
Absolutely.
And it got worse because I ended up developing foot pain in college. I was limping around, doing painkillers, using crutches, went to the various doctors. They just keep upping the dose of ibuprofen. So by the time I'm, 19, 20, 21, somewhere in there, I'm taking like 3,600 milligrams of ibuprofen a day for foot pain.
Wow.
I had to leave school because I couldn't do it anymore. I needed foot surgery. What I needed was a low oxalate diet, it turns out, but I didn't learn that till I was 50 years old. So 30 years later, I figured out that I didn't need that surgery at all. I needed a low oxalate diet. But that high oxalate diet, somehow I was still in enough oxalates in college to stay sick and limping around. Bilateral foot surgery, didn't recover well from that. Eventually got off all the orthotics. I've been on 3 or 4 different styles of orthotics. You go to a different PT person, another doctor, another PT, you kind of go through that whole rigmarole over and over again, as if the next pair of orthotics are going to make a big difference, which they never did. But they did cost a lot of money. And I even got married in sneakers because of the orthotics. And I could stand long enough to go through the ceremony and then sit on a stool to greet the guests and so on.
Wow.
Then when I'm 50, I can now, and of course I'm 60 now. So it's been over 10 years that I've been low oxalate. But early on, within 6 months of the diet, my feet were acting like they should have been acting my whole life. And they hadn't.
Amazing.
For decades.
And you
and I didn't even finish telling you about heart disease. And because one of the major ways you have a heart attack has nothing to do with clogged arteries. It has everything to do with the pacemaker and going into AFib and going into heart failure in a situation they often call heart block, which is electromagnetic failure of the heart. Low calcium is a major cause of that, and fibrotic tissue. Oxalate can cause low calcium. And it causes fibrosis of tissues. So you have fibrotic tissue that doesn't work as well. So the whole mechanism of the muscle isn't as strong and effective and consistent because it's riddled with fibrosis and necrosis and problems. And then you have the electromagnetic system of the pacemaker failing because there's not enough calcium, which is a temporary thing. It only lasts for an hour or so. And then the parathyroid gland tells the bone immune system to start drilling holes in the bone and give us calcium. And the body keeps recovering its calcium levels while you slowly erode your bones over time. But the heart can't wait 2 hours to function.
Yeah. And one thing that's extremely prevalent in our space, and I think in the world in general, and it's probably very underreported is gastrointestinal disease, SIBO, IBS, all of the like. What role do oxalates play in these areas?
Yeah, really, who doesn't have a stomach problem of some kind or other, you know, constipation, diarrhea, indigestion, reflux, poor digestion, poor fat digestion. They end up getting their gallbladders taken out. It's becoming universal, as you say. And, you know, there's lots of things contributing to that. Things like, you know, all these emulsifiers in food and antibiotics and so on. But oxalates and intestinal dysfunction has been known since the 1830s.
Wow.
People would come in rhubarb season. The fancy people could afford these lovely rhubarb tarts, and they would get sick on too much oxalate from rhubarb because in England, where this was a big fad, they eat potatoes every day and 4 cups of tea at minimum every day.
Yeah.
Tea and potatoes are both high in oxalate, neither of which we understood in 1830. Like, it was not easy. It's very tricky to measure oxalate in fluid, whether it's a food fluid like tea or it's your blood or it's your urine. Very tricky to get a good bead on exactly how much is in there. We didn't get good at that until about 1980. So in 1830s and 20s and so on, when oxalate was becoming a big problem and a big interest in science, they could see the crystals in urine, but couldn't necessarily get an exact count of how much oxalic acid and so on is in these things. So they didn't recognize that they were already eating a lot of oxalate from the daily tea and the potatoes. And then when it came rhubarb season, these guys would get sick with intestinal problems and mood shift. This is the two big things they'd see. Things like intestinal, it looks like an obstruction where the guy's going to die from intestinal obstruction. It's probably the nerves misfiring and stuck on and causing a hard cramp. So you get a lot of spasms and tetany and cramping and things like this when your calcium drops. So they're probably having temporary low calcium in the blood, causing nerve dysfunction, which causes muscle dysfunction that looks like various types of IBS and rectal problems and colon regularity things. You can get hiccups, you can get reflux, you can get various places all through the body that do these spasms from the low calcium. So the intestinal problems were always seen as part of the picture of oxalate poisoning. And then this neurological thing where the personality would change or the person, they become neurotic and upset and distressed and their future would look bleak. And it was all part of the, again, the neurotoxicity. So some things that look like digestion are really neurotoxicity. I thought my belching and bloating and hiccuping attacks that I would get at bedtime every night was from SIBO. I was constantly looking pregnant. And it just seemed like SIBO. I had a test done. It came negative, but I treated for SIBO anyway, because I, at this point, had a sleep disorder, neurotoxicity, couldn't sleep. My brain was waking up 29 times an hour. The literature says that's a toxicity coming from endotoxemia, which means you have the bacteria in your gut is causing enough toxicity that it's damaging your brain function. So I was insisting that that was how it works, because that's what it says in the medical literature. So I insisted on treating myself for the SIBO that was really just oxalate poisoning, all of it.
Wow. Interesting. And you've, what are some of those common foods that contain oxalate that people eat without realizing
it? Popular ones right now are the nuts, especially almonds, cashews, and peanuts. Those would be the most popular ones that are really trouble. And then in the leafy green department, there's three greens plus sorrel. There's beet greens, chard, and spinach. And that's it. All the other greens are okay. The fruit department, you have, star fruit is very popular in other countries like South America and in Southeast Asia. That's deadly high in oxalate and other chemicals. There's black raspberries and kiwi and pomegranate, whole pomegranate. The juice isn't too bad. There's what else? I'll think of the other fruit. Something.
How about grains?
Whole bran, anything that's with bran, whole wheat, all those whole grains are high. Even refined wheat can be high. It's variable with corn, variable with oats, because they're all different species and different treatments and so on. So it's all of them contribute to stacking. You know, you have some. If you put lettuce on your sub sandwich. I mean, instead of, if you substitute spinach now, like you can ask for spinach instead of lettuce on your sub sandwich. So you just go out for some random lowbrow sub. And between the bread and the spinach and the random little things, you could build a slightly high oxalate sub even. So potatoes, most people are getting potatoes in some form or another, often more than once a day, because you can eat them breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Every time, if you eat out, you're being offered fries, chips, or baked.
Yep.
There's hash browns in the morning. And so potatoes are, you know, a big contributor in the kind of thing that sets that baseline, like it did in England, where you've got potatoes and tea, and add in another high oxalate food, a little bit of beets, some sweet potatoes. What else in the produce department? Those are the big ones, actually. It's like,
and I see on the poster behind you, you have one of the big ones, chocolate, right?
Yes, not in the produce department, but it is actually. If you go into Walmart in the produce department, you get chocolate covered nuts. And it's being treated like produce now because it has this healthy halo on it. Yes, the cocoa fraction. So the darker the chocolate, the higher the oxalate content. So nowadays you like buzz it right up there into keto, like 100%, 99%, like concentrating the oxalates. So it's very easy to stack in just a little bit of nuts, a little bit of chocolate, a little bit of beets or something, and you're already beyond what the body can handle.
And is coffee high in oxalate as well?
No.
You mentioned tea.
Coffee is low in oxalate, but I wrote a whole blog about that because there's published research that in the title that says coffee's high in oxalate. There's a lot of sloppiness.
Yeah.
People who are working on their tenure really aren't that worried about the nitty gritty of oxalate content in food. Mm.
And what are a few small, easy food swaps people can make that will make a big difference?
Well, instead of spinach, chard, and beet greens, any other green you want, like pretty much even some kale is okay. Everyone says kale and spinach as if it's the same thing.
Yeah.
A serving of kale might have up to 12 milligrams. A serving of spinach is usually over 300 milligrams.
Wow. That's
a huge difference, like whole decimal point plus half that.
Yeah.
Like it's, even though kale at 12 milligrams is high compared to lettuce, which might be 2 or 3, and cabbage, which might be 1 or 2, it's still not a high oxalate food relative to the bad ones. So you can handle some. It's not like you have to, this is not an allergy. People use the term sensitivity when they talk about oxalate, imagining it kind of like a allergy, like wheat and so on. But most of these plant chemicals, even though they cause inflammation and they cause an inflammatory response that feels like an allergy, that feels like an infection, it's the toxicity that's damaging the immune system and turning it on, especially with oxalate, has a special way to keep the immune system revved up. And the feeling of it is like a sensitivity, but it's really a toxicity, and toxicities are tricky to interpret, to recognize it just in your day-to-day life.
What are some other swaps maybe on the grain side for folks who want to continue?
If you're gluten-free, you've probably swapped into really high oxalate grains substitutes, which are, don't do quinoa, buckwheat, teff, arrowroot, and cassava. Those are really high in oxalate. That's like the family of gluten-free. So is almonds and almonds. So if you've gone gluten-free, chances are you're using quinoa, buckwheat, teff. Those are really high. So instead of them, it's a little trickier with the grains, but rice, white rice, better to use starch if you can get it, but you can't. Flour, white rice, pasta, you can use potato starch if you tolerate potato starch. A lot of us do. Some people are sensitive to potatoes from because of other chemicals, you know, that they're part of the nightshade family. But a lot of us with oxalate issues do fine with potato starch, and it has like no oxalate in it. So it's a little trickier. Coconut is very low in oxalate, very. And you can use coconut flour in flour. So, and some people, if they can't handle all of that, they start using things like pork rinds for flour. It's, you know, it's interesting because we're so embedded in our food thinking for the last several thousand years about grains, and the last 100 years about vegetables, and really the last 400 years about things like starchy potatoes and corn and these things, which really haven't been in a global food seen for humans until fairly recently. Even spinach is a fairly recent food, and certainly its availability 365 all the time is totally a product of modern technology. But that's true of the whole produce department. Like, having these foods at all, many of them are been invented by human breeding and selection, just basic selection of certain plants. You can put pollen on the out there in the world of gardening and so on and farming. You pick your prize plants and what they do for you, and you put their pollens together, and you keep breeding them year after year. And in 5 or 6 years, you've created a slightly different plant. And humans have been doing that for a very long time. And the entire produce department, the carrot, all these things are human inventions.
Yeah. And you've helped thousands of people now through the Trying Low Oxalate Facebook group, which I think has like 65,000 members.
Well, that's Susan Owen's group. And I don't actually spend a lot of time there.
But okay.
I know that they're...
I've interviewed Susan.
From my distilling out and rooting around in the medical literature, in my own experience as a nutritionist, explaining this as a nutritional problem, because this is the place where we have the handle. You have complete control over what you put in your mouth.
Yeah.
And you can completely handle any kind of level of oxalate overload in your body by controlling the foods and the vitamin C that you take and how much collagen you're taking. If you're willing to do those three things, you're amazing what you can do.
Yeah. What role do vitamin C and collagen play in helping manage oxalate?
Well, you know how the liver creates some oxalate?
Yeah.
They call that endogenous production. So that's, it's something's becoming oxalate in the body. And those somethings that become oxalate in the body are vitamin C and certain amino acids that are in collagen, hydroxyproline being the big one. So if you see, vitamin C is not endogenous because your body doesn't make it. Mm-hmm. It's strictly something you eat in food. And nowadays you can add it in as a supplement. It's been popular to do so for about 70 years since Linus Pauling. And you're just creating more substrate to increase the amount of quote endogenous production, which isn't really, to me, you call it endogenous, which is a technicality. It's happening. Yeah. When the vitamin C is becoming oxalate, it's mostly in the body, although some tests show that in fluid vitamin C and powder vitamin C supplements, you know, fluids you tend to inject as an IV, 8% of it or some percent of it is already turned into oxalate in the bottle.
What other supplements, common supplements, contain a lot of oxalate?
Mostly the ones that are dehydrated vegetables probably do. They haven't all been tested. There's
like berberine. Would that be one?
I don't think berberine is high. You're testing my memory. The ones that tend to be high are whole root turmeric, whereas curcumin is not high. So that refining process removes the oxalate. There's slippery elm is very high. Lots of crystals. So slippery elm is basically a bark. And so a lot of barks are loaded with crystals. That's why cinnamon is high in oxalate. It's a lot of the crystals. It's not a lot of the oxalic acid ion. So it's not as much that can get into your blood. It's just more of the stuff that's an irritant to the gut.
Yeah.
So there's also olive leaf extract, I think, is pretty high in oxalate.
Okay.
And so is milk thistle.
Milk thistle, got it.
But most of the other supplements are not bad. And same with herbal teas. There's hardly any oxalate in herbal teas. There's some in ginger root tea, but the herbal teas don't somehow diffuse it into the water. And it's interesting because with vegetables, if you boil them enough, some of them diffuse or leach some of the oxalate into the cooking water. So like with broccoli, you can leach out a third, sometimes a half into the water, and then you throw out the water and you lower the oxalate level. Broccoli is not horribly high, but it's better if it's a little lower. You could boil it, but that doesn't work for asparagus. It doesn't work for every vegetable. Mm. It's not like there's one rule for everything, because it's really quite shocking that herbal teas made with cinnamon and other things really are low in oxalate. Mm. And that's a testament to the matrix upon which those crystals are sitting and how you can't really change those crystals very much as long as you can physically remove them. And when you throw away the cinnamon in the tea bag, you know, a lot of these herbal teas have cinnamon in them, but you're throwing away all the solids and you're throwing away a lot of the crystals. And that's what happens when you make potato starch. So there's lots of ways you can remove them with these sort of technologies. But that, so this gives you more freedom to like not worry about high oxalate foods and teas, high oxalate oils, because it's a charged molecule, so it doesn't hang out with the fat. The fat, remember, the fat repels water. Water is a charged or polar molecule, and the nonpolar fats repel the oxalate. So you don't have peanut oil, almond oil, those things don't have oxalate in them. So you don't have to worry about your creams and lotions that have oils. It's all fine. So there's a few little technicalities where, you know what, you can relax a little bit here and there. You don't have to get too wigged out.
Okay. And as I was saying, you've helped so many people throughout their oxalate journeys. What are some of the most impressive case studies you've seen and what results have people had from managing their oxalate?
This is so magical. I could almost cry. The kinds of suffering that people have been through and then how quickly they see a benefit and see the connection to the oxalates and they change their diet. It's stunning. And the first thing that shocked me was how many people had really serious anxiety and other mental health issues that were chronic for them for decades.
Wow.
One person, we didn't work together. It was just an Instagram communication, but she said it so succinctly. Hey, I've been in weekly therapy for my anxiety for 30 years. In a matter of weeks of changing my diet, I don't feel I need it at all.
Amazing.
That's a pretty easy fix.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine all that money and time and effort and sadness. And it's very difficult to live with anxiety.
Extremely.
Really tough life. And you make everyone else around you crazy too.
Yeah.
You become annoying to live with, which is the sort of, you know, lightweight thing to say that it stresses your relationships a lot. So it's not just you that's suffering. And that's true with all health problems. That we don't live in isolation. We live in families and communities. So
absolutely,
all of these things are profoundly affecting not just the individual person, but everybody around them. And not everybody gets the support. I'll get back to some more amazing recoveries, but I see real differences in how much support people get from their spouses and their children and their parents and their sisters and their neighbors and their church friends. And I'm really saddened by how many people who've had chronic health problems have been basically dropped and written off by family members. And they really are feeling alone. So we have this community of people coming together from all over the world who are having incredible recoveries from things their doctors just ignored or, you know, decided it was their anxiety. Everyone likes to say, oh, well, you just need to relax and you'll be okay. Manage your stress, be okay. But it's amazing how many things recover. So the whole mental health issue was really surprising. I've had people disabled with depression. And sometimes the depression is much harder and slower, but give it time. Within a couple of years, that lifts too. And their ability to experience true joy, peace, self-satisfaction, and confidence again is really fantastic. So there's the mental health piece, aches and pains, all kinds of ouchies, gout and muscle problems, tendonitises, arthritises, things that start interfering with any physical activity, they'll go away. Sometimes they come back in little waves because there's a whole accumulation problem and there's an immune system and connective tissue damage that's happening from the oxalate because we're way surpassing the kidney's ability to excrete it, the vascular system ability to tolerate it, and the rest of the tissues, they're just having to do this secondary thing of holding onto it and managing it in the background. And now when you stop eating it, the background area is like finally getting relief. Once the kidneys clear out and urinary tract's ready, you can start clearing it out. So you get better. And then sometimes you have to cycle through some issues for some times forward. So other issues are things like vision, night vision problems, even visual acuity, glaucoma type thing. So people have reversed their cataracts.
Wow.
Because it's causing oxidative stress. And so that oxidative stress starts to create that cloudiness in the lens. And the fact that the lens can heal is pretty cool.
Yeah, incredible.
My visual, I don't have astigmatism anymore. The night vision problems that I was starting to develop went away. and I can deal with today's glaring headlights, no problem. I don't have to like that, but I still can see.
Yeah.
And even my reading correction seems to be getting less, even though I'm now 60, rather than worse. I have been messed up. My eyes, my visual acuity has not been good because of Oxley. It started when I was probably 12 or 13, somewhere in there. I needed glasses by 16. So there's the eyes, there's the mental health, there's the joint stuff, there's energy levels, a lot of fatigue. What's happening is people come to me with these problems. They're like, I think there's an Oxley connection. I'm like, oh, tell me all about that. And then I go read about the literature and look at the work with them and read the literature. I'm like, yep, they're right. And so it isn't in our textbooks. So it seems like I'm making stuff up, but it's actually in the literature showing that these problems are occurring. People have improved their heart function. I've had people completely clean out crystal filled bladders, kidney stones releasing pain-free, relief of chronic pain, pelvic pain, relief of interstitial cystitis, improved liver function, improved chemical sensitivity, improved back pain. What else? Oh, you name it. Connective tissue problems. So this is something that most of us until recently didn't hear much about. I think now because of you guys who are doing podcasts and there's this whole learnism out there now that we can share our stories through you guys who host podcasts, that more of these things are coming into recognition by people who are on this searching learning course. And connective tissue is one of the major arenas where oxalate is interfering with our health. The connective tissue somehow tends to collect the oxalates. It can turn those connective tissues calcified. There's a process in cells where just the presence of oxalate not just creates calcium oxalate, but causes other forms of calcium formation in these tissues. So calcifications and inflammation in the connective tissue causes them to become stiff and dysfunctional, and you can get stuck with adhesions and stuff out of joint and stuff that won't go back into joint. You've got the maintenance of that connective tissue is slowed down, probably for the same reasons everything else maintenance-wise is slowed down. The interference with the enzymes that produce energy, the inflammation in the cells that are doing the tissue maintenance. And then there's this shifting in the connective tissue because oxalate itself is acidic, and the inflammation that it's causing in the connective tissues causes acidity. And when you have acidity in the connective tissues, the molecules literally shift. So all tissues are built of molecules and they're all oriented a certain way. And when they shift, because now the calcium phase of the protein is shifting because of the pH, now they're not the same shape and they're more sticky to each other. So this is how it's promotes adhesions. So fascia starts becoming stickier and stickier when there's more inflammation and acidity. So a lot of that can clear up. You can probably fix some of your postural problems and start working out. And it's amazing.
Yeah. Incredible. And you mentioned earlier, which I really appreciate, you know, you don't, when you're talking about kale, you don't have to go to 100% zero oxalate. And a lot of people like to take things to extremes. So what is an acceptable level of oxalate?
Well, it's very individual. One thing that's real obvious from the literature and from real life is that it's affecting everybody very differently. And so it shows up as all these different kinds of conditions. Some people have multiple systemic things wrong with them, with the fibromyalgia and the fatigue and the this and that and the mood problems. Other people, it's just like their bladder or their this or their that, or their shoulder, frozen shoulder, locked jaw, water on the brain, whatever. So each person's situation is a little bit different. And the what's considered a normal level of oxalate intake is about 150 milligrams a day. And that is also right about what we're built to handle. So it would be nice to get down to close to the normal level eventually. Some people can get there pretty quickly and quite safely. And some people need to go all the way to a low oxalate diet, which is under 60 milligrams a day. And then there's the carnivore folks who generally are pretty much close to zero unless they're doing some tea and things like that. So the thing is, if you've been doing these smoothies that have spinach and almond butter and so on, that's 1,000 milligrams a day.
Wow.
So that's 8 times what you're built to handle.
Yeah.
That's the danger zone. I mean, that's really toxic level of exposure. And some people do that every single day. And then they add in like almond stuff, using almond flour to be keto or whatever. And then the chocolate and mixing together sweet potatoes and chocolate to make a sort of sugar-free, cakey, brownie-ish, pancakey thing. And people are throwing spinach into pancake. Like, you can start stacking these foods that deliver 100, 200, 300, 700. You know, your standard smoothie is at least 700 milligrams, but I think some people can do as much as 2 grams of oxalate just in a smoothie. They'll do a big giant one and they'll stuff so much spinach and add a little turmeric and like magically keep adding in things that are high oxalate. So if you've been in this really danger zone place, and if you're really sick, you may need to keep enough oxalate in there just to keep your system from responding so aggressively to the desire to have it out of the tissues. You don't want to release oxalic acid from your tissues too quickly. If for no other reason is that you need to keep your calcium levels consistent in your blood. And if you're releasing a calcium chelator from your thyroid gland, that's another thing that cleans up pretty well, as Hashimoto's and hypothyroid tends to improve at least somewhat. But if it's coming out of your frozen shoulder and your crickety jaw and your teeth and your sinuses, et cetera, all at the same time, you could really mess with your calcium levels and get into heart arrhythmias and potentially even promote the conditions that allow for stroke and heart attacks and things like that. It's not likely for most people, but it's possible. And a lot of people do end up in the emergency room after they go low oxalate, because this stress of being re-toxified, you're just recirculating this old poison that your body has carefully sequestered and kept you functional and kept you fairly well, but you don't want to stir the pot on that and have that pouring out. So ideally, you figure out, you come down in a sort of systematic way if you can, and you figure out if you're going so low that you start feeling sick again on those kinds of symptoms where you start getting weird stuff, eye crystals, grit coming out of the stools, lots of cloudy urine, crystally urine, waking up at night. If you get more of these oxalate symptoms that would suggest releasing from the tissues, staying too low too long just can aggravate a toxicity, weirdly enough.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that before, the kind of tapered approach to lowering your oxalate.
Tapered, at least awareness so that you can start using oxalate because the body's smart. And if you're telling it, hey, I'm eating oxalates again, go back to like holding. If you can get it to hold it in place, that's actually safer than unleashing it. People think, oh, you mean I've filled up with oxalate crystals? How do I get them out like today? That's the opposite of what you want to have it just slowly leaking out, nice and calm, low, non-toxic, so you can carry on with your life. You do not want to poison yourself from the old oxalate hanging around.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone wants to go from 100 to 0, but that's not always the smartest approach.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's really only been in modern times, I think, where it's so possible early in life, by the time you're 12, to be loaded with oxalate, because the refrigerator and the modern idea that you can have nuts year round, that's all new.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, talk a little bit about the book, Sally, Toxic Superfoods. Where can people get it? What can they expect to find inside it? And what made you write it?
Well, I decided to write a book because, well, at least if my life was ruined by oxalate, someone else's life may not be, or they can, in that we can do more with this understanding we have now from our personal experiences if we put it in a place that can last. And more people with more talents and brains and resources than I have can move this science forward. In the meantime, help someone else. Because I knew, that I wasn't the only one. There had to be at least 5 other people with this problem. There had to be. But it turns out humanity has this problem. That was a real shocking revelation to me, is understanding the science and understanding how our health is going to heck and how many people... Even if you have nothing wrong with you, you benefit from getting less of a toxin every day. That should be an easy thing to understand, of course. Yeah. Why didn't I understand that? Because we don't appreciate how toxic this is. Mm-hmm. And so the book is explaining lots of things, including all the beginning questions like, wait a minute. I mean, plants have something bad in them. You got plants are great. Plants are so perfect. That's what we're supposed to live on. Like, okay, we got to talk about that one because, it turns out we've been sold a bill of goods about how fabulous plants are. And that's a hard one to swallow because look, we've been trusting the doctors, the influencers, even the researchers who believe in this. Like kindergartners in school, you don't question your teacher. You go to school, teacher tells you the facts of life and you believe them forever. And you never stop to think for yourself. You're just indoctrinated in it. So there's a chapter about that tries to cover where this all comes from and how did nutrition miss it? Why is medicine missing out on it? And try to explain that and give you some examples of how this works so you can make more sense of it. Shared, you know, there's various little micro stories shared through it to try to illustrate the points. And there's information about how accumulation happens, which has been missing. That's one it's minimal in the research, although I can pull up for you 50 articles. And to you and I, 50 articles sounds like something, but in medicine, if there's not 10,000 articles on it, it's like, well, we don't know what doesn't count yet. But in our lifetimes, it has to count. We don't have time to wait for other people to wake up for us. And it's really clear that 75% of us at least have frank, visible, findable oxalate crystals in our thyroid gland by the time we're 50. That's unacceptable pathology that looks like it's universal in human bodies. You also have it in your bone marrow, in your eyes, in your connective tissue, in the bones themselves, and your kidneys. Everyone dies with some degree of oxalate in their kidneys. But we don't have to have any of this in our tissues. Yeah. Because the amount you produce from your endogenous production is well below your capacity to get rid of it. It's 100% about the way we eat. So there's accumulation and there's a deaccumulation. There's charts throughout the book of like, here's the worst offenders. Here's the low oxalate foods. Here's some intermediate ones. And there's a chart in the back that's meant to be a way for you to add an oxalate for those who are carnivore and are really limiting these high oxalate foods to a great degree. You may find this is an easy medication to get you out of trouble if you are having oxalate deaccumulation. Well, here's how you would add 20, 30, 50, whatever amount of oxalates that might work for you with certain foods. So this much food might have about this much. And you can approximate it and start playing around with, you know what, if I have some tea and some olives at lunch, I feel better by dinner time. And then I have a better night's sleep.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Sally. I learned something from you every single time. I'm sure the audience will as well. And I highly encourage everyone to check out the book, pick up a copy, support Sally for all the great work she's done. And thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. I'm so glad you want to keep talking oxalates. And, you know, maybe in the future we'll talk some more about cases and
absolutely.
It is amazing. So
I'd love
thank
that.
You for helping people discover this topic. It's wonderful.
Thank you. You're doing fantastic work.
Thank you for listening to the show. You can find The Scott Mize Show on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Please leave a comment, like, review, or share the podcast with your friends or followers. It helps more people find the show.